Chapter 9. Under the Law. The Parasite. In the last chapter, we looked at the traditions of the fathers that Paul faithfully followed before his vision on the road to Damascus. We also looked at the law as a constant in both God's and Paul's equation. In this chapter, we will look at how Paul derived his concept of under law and how not being under law cannot possibly mean freedom from obedience of the law of Moses. The law is not the problem. The husband is. If one goes to Numbers chapter 5 in the Septuagint and reads the entire context, specifically verses 19 and 20 and 29, the phrase is, "If you have not gone astray to become defiled while under your own husband," and then in verse 20, "But if you have gone astray being under your husband," and then verse 29, "This is the law of jealousy, in case a woman who is under her husband goes astray." The word in Greek for under is hupo, from which we get the word hypo, as in hypoallergenic, meaning fewer or decreased allergens. In the passage above, "while she is under her husband" cannot be in reference to her location spatially, meaning she was not actually underneath her husband physically, but under her husband figuratively, as in under his authority, or bound to him legally, like in a marriage. The ESV correctly picked up on this idea and translated it as "under her husband's authority" in verses 19, 20, and 29. To be under the law seems to be used in the exact same way in every passage in the New Testament where Paul used it. The Greek word for under in the New Testament is the same word hupo. The problem is the husband, not the law. Please let me explain. We said in the previous chapter that the law was like a saxophone, and it must be played by someone. The husband in the Numbers 5 passage is the one who gets to play the saxophone, as it were. He gets to use the law when he suspects his wife has been unfaithful to him sexually, and he has the freedom to either call for the prosecution to the fullest extent of the law for his potentially wayward wife, or he may choose to not call on the law's punitive measures at all. The law is to be obeyed by both the wife and the husband, but the punishment, the consequences for one who has transgressed the law with respect to the husband, is at the husband's discretion, meaning he can choose to have her punished or forgive her. I believe that the husband is the key to understanding Paul's usage of under the law in Romans, 1 Corinthians, and Galatians. I sincerely believe that what we Christians need in order to, quote, decode, end quote, Paul's writings in the New Testament is Paul's dictionary of terms. Wouldn't that be nice? If only we had Paul's dictionary to define all the terms he used in his letters. Actually, we all very likely have several copies of Paul's dictionary in several different versions. We call his book of definitions the Old Testament, and specifically the Septuagint, which is the ancient Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. Consider another husband whose wife showed every sign of promiscuity, so much so that her belly grew to the size of a watermelon. Leviticus 20 verse 10 commands, "If a man commits adultery with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death." But what did Joseph do? Did he obey the law of Moses? Yes and no. The law clearly said that both the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. But what did Joseph choose when he used the law? He chose to send her away quietly or privately with a certificate of divorce. He wanted so badly to believe her, that God had truly given her the baby that was growing inside her womb, but that was a pill too big for him to swallow. But rather than seek her death, he sought to spare her life and divorce her quietly. And her husband Joseph, being a just man and unwilling to put her to shame, resolved to divorce her quietly. Matthew chapter 1 and verse 19. The one to whom we were legally bound, or the authority we found ourselves under in the entire sixth chapter of Romans, was sin, not the law. Sin was our husband, because we presented our members to him, became his slaves, and gave ourselves over to obey his passions. For that is exactly what Romans 6, verses 13 and 19 says. Do not present your members to sin as instruments for unrighteousness, but present yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and your members to God as instruments for righteousness. I am speaking in human terms because of your natural limitations. For just as you once presented your members as slaves to impurity and to lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves to righteousness, leading to sanctification. Romans chapter 6, verses 13 and 19. Sin was the one under whom we were legally bound until Jesus redeemed us. That is, until Jesus bought us with a price and brought us back into the Father's house. For that is what redeem, or goel in Hebrew, means, to bring back into the Father's house. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. Galatians 4, 4 and 5. Notice in verse 5 of Galatians 4, the reason we were redeemed from under the law. It does not say so that we could obey a new law of grace, or not have to obey a bunch of so-called Jewish laws. The reason we were redeemed from under the law, according to Paul in verse 5, was so that we might receive adoption as sons and daughters. Huh? That's right. Logically, we can deduce that if one is under the law, he or she is not a candidate for adoption by God. Remember, God honors his own legal terms. Therefore, if you and I are the legal property of another, God will honor said legality. One cannot be justified, or said another way, be a legitimate child of God while being legally owned by someone else. This makes perfect sense, because whomever has been legally sold under sin is under the legal custody of sin. For that is exactly what Romans 7 and verse 14 says. Being under the law is about custody rights. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am of the flesh, sold under sin. Romans 7 and verse 14. We were sold under sin. That is another way of saying that we were legally bound to sin, subject to sin's dominion, governance, and control. We belonged to sin, and until we were released from the dominion of sin, we were Mr. Sin's legal slaves. He owned us. This is yet another reason why Jesus had to die and shed his blood. The whole point of Jesus being born in the flesh, born under the law, and dying on the cross was to complete a legal transaction to get us out from under our contract to sin. He bought us with the blood that coursed through his veins for 30 years. There we stood, damaged goods, beaten and bloody, dressed in rags, hair unkempt, bruised, filthy. We were Mr. Sin's whipping boy. But Jesus purchased us from off of the auction block. Then he brought us back to the Father's house. That is when God bent down, placed his finger under our chin, lifted our head, and looked us straight in the eyes, and said, I love you so much. I choose you. Will you be my child? Paul's dictionary was the Torah and the prophets. Paul was not talking about the law of Moses that we are no longer under. Paul was talking about the law of sin and death. In fact, that is precisely what he says two chapters later in Romans 8 and verse 2. For the law of the Spirit of life has set you free in Christ Jesus from the law of sin and death. When sin and death mediate the law, they will always seek our demise, our death, through the very law that God has always desired for us to obey. But when Jesus is mediator of the same law, he always seeks to spare our life. That is what under the law, or better said, under the authority of the one who mediates the law, means. The law is not the problem. The husband is. Our husband, that is, the one to whom we have bound ourselves, has always been the problem, if and when that husband is sin and death. Verses 3 and 4 of Romans 8 go on to explain. For God has done what the law, weakened by the flesh, could not do, by sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh. And for sin, he condemned sin in the flesh, in order that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us, who walk not according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. Please look carefully at several things in this passage. The law was weakened by the flesh, weakened by human men and women. The law was unable to condemn sin in the flesh without condemning the whole person. Jesus came as a human man, sinful flesh, and for the destruction of sin, and it was only he who was able to condemn sin forever in the flesh. To what avail? To beat up the neighborhood bully? No. In order that the righteousness of the law might be pleidothe, fulfilled, filled to overflowing, carried into effect in and through us. Pleidothe is the exact same word fulfilled that means to fill up, to fill to the top, and to carry into effect. God, Jesus, and Paul all expect us to carry the righteousness of the law into effect. How is this accomplished? By obeying the law out of love for our God. When obeying God's commands, there are two stewards over the law, you might say, two interpreters, two legal counsels mediating. Jesus is one of the mediators of the law. Sin and death are the other. We are under one of those two. To be under law is to be subject to, bound to, and under the dominion of the law's ultimate stowaway, the great parasite called sin. How is sin a parasite? Remember, without law, there is no sin. The law is the host. And sin, the parasite, cannot live without the host to feed on. Romans 7 explains perfectly what happened to the law. But sin, seizing an opportunity through the commandment, produced in me all kinds of covetousness. For apart from the law, sin lies dead. I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin came alive, and I died. The very commandment that promised life proved to be death to me. For sin, seizing an opportunity through the commandment, deceived me, and through it killed me. So the law is holy, and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. Did that which is good, then, bring death to me? By no means. It was sin, producing death in me through what is good, in order that sin might be shown to be sin, and through the commandment might become sinful beyond measure. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am of the flesh, sold under sin. Dear reader, does it make any sense that Paul would call the law holy and the commandment holy and righteous and good, and then tell us that we must not obey that commandment? You must decide, dear reader, which interpretation has the ring of truth to it. Under the law cannot mean obedience of the law of Moses. It must mean obedience of Mr. Sin, who has parasitically attached himself to the holiness and righteousness and goodness of the law, siphoning off the life while excreting nothing but death. Therefore, if we choose to sin or break God's law, we are offering ourselves as obedient slaves to Mr. Sin. That is exactly what Paul said in Romans 6. The law is not the problem. The one to whom we give our obedience is the problem, if that one is Mr. Sin. We are not under law. We are under grace. But that only means that the one we obey is the one who has the power to mediate mercifully. Were we to be under law, our only appeal would be to sin and death. And, my friends, no mercy shall ever be found under those two oppressors. So speak and so act as those who are to be judged under the law of liberty or freedom. For judgment is without mercy to one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. James chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. James seems to be echoing the same idea that Jesus taught in Matthew 12, verses 7 and 8, quoted above. And if you had known what this means, I desired mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Jesus was quoting directly from Hosea 6 and verse 6. Hosea's point was the same as Jesus' point, which was the same as James' point. Mercy, steadfast love, and grace all triumph over judgment. James had more to say about the law that sheds even greater light for us. But be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks intently at his natural face in a mirror. For he looks at himself and goes away, and at once forgets what he was like. But the one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres, being no hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, he will be blessed in his doing. James chapter 1, verses 22 through 25. A couple of noteworthy items in James' passage above. James tells his readers to be doers of the word. There's that word again. Remember, James gets his terms from the First Testament. He does not define what the word is here, but assumes that his readers already know the definition. Look at verse 31 from Numbers 15 and notice the equivalence between the Lord's commandment and the word of the Lord. But the person who does anything with a high hand, whether he is a native or a sojourner, reviles the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from among his people, because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment. That person shall be utterly cut off. His iniquity shall be on him. Numbers 15, verses 30 and 31. In the Deuteronomy 5 passage below, what Moses spoke to all Israel were the statutes and rules that he said he declared as the word of the Lord. And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the rules that I speak in your hearing today, and you shall learn them and be careful to do them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Not with our fathers did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, while I stood between the Lord and you at that time, to declare to you the word of the Lord." Deuteronomy 5, 1 through 5. The Isaiah 2 passage below is a beautiful example of Hebrew parallelism at work in the text. Zion is Jerusalem, and the law is the word of the Lord. "And many peoples shall come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." Isaiah 2 and verse 3. James, in the original passage above, calls the law of Moses perfect and a law of freedom or liberty. Freedom from what, James? Freedom from obeying the law? That certainly would not make any sense. Maybe James means freedom from the tyrannical despotism and oppression under the law, or as Paul described it, freedom from being under the dominion of sin. Look at what the Hebrew writer said in chapter 10 regarding the legal transaction that had to occur in order to release humanity from the bondage under which humanity was held. "For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has trampled underfoot the Son of God, or has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified, and has outraged the Spirit of grace?" You see, when Jesus died on the cross, he freed us from bondage, not obedience. By casting off the law as that which shackled us, we are, as the Hebrew writer pointed out, outraging the Spirit of grace and throwing out Jesus' payment. Were you ever taught that by not obeying God's perfect law, that you were outraging his Spirit and spitting on Jesus' sacrifice? I certainly was not. James and the Hebrew writer both mention that judgment will be without mercy. James indicates that mercy will not be shown to one who has shown no mercy to others. The Hebrew writer says that the one who will be shown no mercy is the very one who has set aside the law of Moses. this person will die on the evidence of two or three witnesses. I wonder if the two witnesses that will put that person to death are not Mr. Sin and Mr. Death. The considerable misunderstanding of Paul's usage of under law and under grace in Christian thought has most unfortunately led Christians to jettison the law of Moses altogether. Christianity has inherited yet another lie. We inherited the understanding that since we are not under the law, that must mean that we are not to obey the law of Moses, but rather a different law, a new law of grace, which presumably comes from Christ. To be under grace, however, is simply the opposite of being under law. Under law means under the dominion of sin, while under grace means under the dominion of Jesus Christ, the righteous. For freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. Look, I, Paul, say to you that if you accept circumcision, Christ will be of no advantage to you. I testify again to every man who accepts circumcision that he is obligated to keep the whole law. You are severed from Christ, you who would be justified by the law. You've fallen away from grace. Galatians 5, verses 1 through 4. It is very easy to misread Paul. I have misread Paul most of my life. Christ has set us free. That statement alone implies that we were not free prior to Christ's liberation. For freedom, Christ has set us free. In other words, Christ did not set us free so that we might become slaves all over again to the same master from whom we were just set free. Christ set us free in order that we might remain free. Paul then charges the Galatians to not submit or subject themselves again to a yoke of slavery. This has to mean that these Galatian God-fearers were at one time bound or enslaved to a set of teachings. Were these prior teachings of the Pharisaical Takanot from a counterfeit Torah? Or were the Galatians enslaved to a previous standard of teaching under sin, also known as the works of the flesh? Presently, they were being pressured to get circumcised as a matter of salvation. They were being told that they could not be justified or be declared sons of Abraham unless they were circumcised. Paul then says, look, if you accept circumcision as a means of being justified as a son of Abraham, then Christ will be of no advantage to you. My question was, why not? Why couldn't someone get circumcised and keep Christ? This question has everything to do with the content of this chapter. If one appeals to the law as his or her means of justification, remember, one does not appeal to the law, but to the parasite attached to the law. Sin mediates through the law, just like Jesus. If you seek to be justified, which means to be declared innocent, straight, upright, guiltless, or a legal son or daughter by means of the law, sin will take advantage of the law and will promptly accuse you unto death. The only way to escape death is to keep the law perfectly. That is Paul's point in verse 3. You are severed from Christ, you who would be justified legally or by the law. Justification is the key to understanding the entire letter to the Galatians, in my opinion. Justification always came through promise, not legal proceedings. Paul wrote, "You are severed from Christ, you who would be justified by the law." Notice that he does not say, "you who would obey the law." It is about justification. We are either justified legally, that is, by the law itself, or we are justified by promise through Jesus the Messiah. If we choose to be justified legally, we choose to be bound by the whole law, the good and the bad, the blessings and the curses, the life and the death. Our mediator, by default, is the parasite of the law, Mr. Sin, and he will always accuse us unto death. If we choose justification through faith in the promise God made to Abraham, the gospel, that in Jesus Messiah, all the nations, or Gentiles, of the earth will be blessed, then all the families of the earth have the opportunity to be included into the family of God through promise and not through legal proceedings. If Jesus is your justifier, he has jurisdiction and will always seek to spare your life. Notice what you have fallen away from in verse 4 of Galatians 5. Grace. Paul said you have fallen from grace. This is why we need to recall multiple chapters and letters from Paul if we hope to see the thread of continuity that he wove through most all of his letters. We have fallen from grace. Is this not the same idea as Romans 6? You are not under law, but under grace. How could it be any different? I told my brothers and sisters in Christ the following during a study we did of the letter to the Galatians. We cannot understand Galatians if we don't have the letter to the Romans open at the same time to define all of Paul's terms. That study of Galatians took us just over 13 months. We studied for around 4 hours a week. There were days when we didn't get past 3 words from one sentence. For good reason, Peter declared that Paul's letters are hard to understand. How much more so when we are 2,000 years removed, speak a totally different language, and come from a completely alien culture? The cipher and the keystone. Galatians 5 may very well be the keystone for understanding Paul's enigmatic phrase, under the law. But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. For these are opposed to each other, to keep you from doing the things you want to do. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Notice Paul's style here. Verse 16, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. Spirit positive, desires of the flesh negative. Verse 17, the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit. Flesh versus Spirit. Again, he placed them over against each other, just like in verse 16. And in case he didn't make himself clear, he said the same thing in reverse order. The desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. Then, to make sure his point was not lost on his readers, he clarified once more. These are opposed to each other. Verse 18. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under law. Wait, what? What happened? We had a ping-pong game going here, Paul. Flesh versus spirit, spirit versus flesh. Spirit does this and flesh does that. Flesh goes here, spirit goes there. Then all of a sudden, Paul made an illegal substitution. Foul! Somebody blow the whistle! Paul can't do that. But alas, that's why I missed it for my entire life. Paul didn't make an illegal substitution. He didn't commit a foul. We can't blow the whistle. The only thing Paul did was call the player by his other name. Under the law means to come under the dominion of sin, which will make you obey the passions of the flesh. Where do I get this? Remember, what is so helpful in order to understand Paul is to have recall of different chapters of his letters and sometimes different letters altogether. Romans 6 says, "Let not sin, therefore, reign in your mortal body to make you obey its passions. Do not present your members to sin as instruments for unrighteousness, but present yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and your members to God as instruments for righteousness. For sin will have no dominion over you, since you are not under law, but under grace." And that's when it hit me. Under law, works of the flesh and sin acting through the law are all the same thing in Paul's mind. Please consider reading Galatians 5, 16 through 24 as one continuous thought and theme. "But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. For these are opposed to each other, to keep you from doing the things you want to do. But if you are led by the Spirit, you're not under the law. Now the works of the flesh are evident: sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and things like these. I warn you, as I warned you before, that those who do such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. And those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires." Paul did not suddenly change players in verse 18. It would be so easy to think that he abruptly began talking about not obeying the law of Moses. But that would have to mean that Paul's use of the contrastive word "but" in verse 18 was setting the obedience of the law of Moses against the Spirit. Logic and common sense would indicate that the law of Moses was never against the Spirit, since it came directly from God Himself, as Ezekiel 37 and verse 27 unquestionably states. Zechariah 7, verses 11 and 12 also has something to say about the Spirit and the law. "But they refused to pay attention and turned a stubborn shoulder and stopped their ears that they might not hear. They made their hearts diamond hard, lest they should hear the law and the words that the Lord of hosts had sent by His Spirit through the former prophets." Paul had to still be talking about the same two opponents, the Spirit and the flesh. And if that is true, then the flesh and under the law have to be equals in verse 18. Said another way, if you are led by the Spirit, you are not led by the flesh. And if the flesh and under the law are equals in verse 18, Paul could not have made an abrupt departure from the two players in verse 19 either. He also could not be equating the spirit and the works of the flesh. The players never changed. Paul was and has been speaking of the spirit and the flesh all along. Paul wished his readers to remember that if they were sold under sin, they were bound legally to sin. They belonged to sin, or were slaves of sin, since it was sin whom they obeyed. But if they were sold under Christ, bound to Christ, and slaves to obedience, they belonged to none other than Christ Jesus himself. They had been unchained from their former owner, Mr. Sin, and now God could and did legally adopt them as his own children. What a God we serve! This entire chapter has attempted to demonstrate that we cannot apply modern definitions to Paul's words. On the contrary, unless we apply ancient definitions to Paul's words, definitions that come not from the Webster's Dictionary or even the New Testament, but from the exact same place where Paul got his definitions, the Law of Moses and the Prophets, we will be hard-pressed to ever understand what Paul was truly saying to his readers through his letters. The phrase, not under the law, has gone unchallenged in Christianity for far too long. Its contemporary meaning and application have been assumed, despite their lack of compatibility with the teachings surrounding the phrase. If Paul's claim that you are not under the law means you need not obey the law of Moses, then Christianity has some very difficult textual contradictions to resolve and justify. But if the phrase, you are not under the law, means you have been unshackled from the dominion of sin and the obedience of the works of the flesh, then Christianity needs to take a long, hard look at the law of Moses. We need to begin to ask some questions concerning what Paul himself described as the law's holiness, righteousness, and goodness. And we need to inquire as to the law's meaning and application in the life of a follower of Jesus the Messiah. Please, dear reader, do not conform to complacency. Do not concede to comfort. We must stop tolerating the contradictions in our beliefs and practices. The law was never for the Jews alone. It was for Israel. And the greatest kept secret since the 4th century AD is that everyone who has ever or will ever attach himself or herself to God through his son Jesus is part of Israel. Heaven and earth are still here witnessing the existence and endurance of God's perfect law since Moses called them as witnesses in Deuteronomy chapter 30 and 31. Jesus reminded his disciples that those same two witnesses, heaven and earth, remain. Nothing has changed regarding the law's endurance, strength, beauty, grace, and life-giving quality. Remember the words of Jesus. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truth I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes, looses, or unbinds one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same, he will be called least among those in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great among those in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Matthew 5, verses 17 through 20.